You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Edgar B. Herwick III. William Styron casts a long shadow over the 20th century American literary landscape. His 1951 debut novel, Lie Down in Darkness, garnered incredible acclaim. He was just 26 years old. He was instrumental in founding the literary journal, The Paris Review. He would go on to write books like The Confession of Nat Turner. He received a Pulitzer Prize for fiction for that one. And, of course, Sophie's Choice. For much of his life, though, he battled through his days under his own shadow, the shadow of depression, a struggle that he wrote about vividly and candidly in his 1990 memoir, Darkness Visible. But as anybody who has lived with or around somebody with depression knows, a life lived with depression does not mean that life was not thoroughly lived. And so it was for William and his wife, Rose, who would travel the world and whose friends and confidants included presidents, poets, literary legends, everybody from the Kennedys to James Baldwin, Truman Capote, Norman Mailer. And now, 6 years after Styron's death at the age of 81, his wife and historian R. Blakeslee Gilpin are offering us a new look at his life through his own words. They've collected and compiled more than 1,000 of the author's letters in a book, Selected Letters of William Styron. Rose is going to be speaking about that book today in Harvard Square at 7 o'clock at Harvard Bookstore. But before she does that, she's with me right now in the studio. Welcome, Rose.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here.
Lovely to be here.
So I want to start at the beginning of this, which is basically this project. None of this happens unless you and William Styron don't get together. So how did you two meet? How did you come to know him in the first place?
We met momentarily when I was a student at Johns Hopkins. He had written his first novel, Lie Down in Darkness. My Professor Lewis Rubin, who was a Southerner and a pal of Bill Styron's, invited him up to speak. It was the first time he had spoken. It was to all the writing classes that got together at Hopkins. And he was so nervous and bumbling
really?
That we all went up and shook his hand afterwards and left, and I honestly never thought about him again. And then I was in Rome, and I got a letter from this same professor saying, "Hey, you remember Bill Styron?" Which I barely did, but he's in Rome too. He doesn't know anybody. He just arrived. If he has a Prix de Rome, the first novelist to get a Prix de Rome for the American Academy. And if you get up there for any reason, look him up.
Okay.
So I happened like 2 nights later to have a date with a fellow at the American Academy. I was enthralled by this beautiful Stanford White.
The guy you were on the date with?
No. The guy who built the Academy.
Oh, I see.
I was bored to death with my date. And I thought, well, I'll never get up here again, but it's a great place. And as I was leaving, I saw the little cubby holes where the fellows had got their mail, and I saw Bill Styron. So I stopped and wrote him a note saying, "Lewis Rubin said I should say hello. Saw you at Johns Hopkins. If you want to, here's my phone number," period.
Wow.
So that's how we met. He called me 24 hours later.
Good. And
invited me for a drink in the little tiny basement bar at the Excelsior Hotel in Rome. I walked down the steps wondering if I would possibly remember what he looked like.
Right.
And he was sitting there with Truman Capote.
So that was a dead giveaway.
That was a dead giveaway. And I was thrilled to meet Capote, whose books I had read and treasured, but I got into a lot of trouble because he said, oh, yes, he remembered me from Johns Hopkins, which I knew he didn't. And I said, and I loved your book, which I hadn't read. So I got into a lot of trouble when we started going out together the next night and kept on going out in Rome every
great
night.
Great story. Great story. So eventually, you guys spent a lot of time in Italy, eventually made your way back to the United States. And, you know, sort of fast forward, you guys would settle into New England and have strong ties here, both in Connecticut and on Cape Cod. How did you sort of make your way up here into New England?
Well, I had been to Wellesley, and to be honest, I'd always wanted to live in this area. I grew up in Baltimore and had a wonderful childhood, but knew I'd leave, and I wanted to live in New England. And Bill had lived in New York before I knew him, so he came back to New York. And he had told me before we came, that he hated New York. But Italy was so beautiful, and we lived in Ravello in a converted jail that looked over the Amalfi Coast, and it was so beautiful, Bill couldn't write.
Yeah. He,
you
know,
it was too distracting. He wrote part of a novel called Blankenship, and he said, "I got to go home and face a blank wall, and we have to go back to New York." This was after a 9-month honeymoon, when all our Paris Review friends and Roman American Academy of Rome friends joined us on our honeymoon, so we had quite a wonderful time, and he didn't get any work done.
Yeah.
So we went back to New York. We lasted not even 2 months.
Really?
It was awful. It was just not his thing. And he said, "I always hated New York." So we moved to the Connecticut countryside because his agent offered us a house to borrow and sent a real estate agent to see us. And we bought the first house we saw because it was beautiful, Litchfield County, Connecticut.
Hmm. And you'd spend decades in that house. You'd raise your family in that house. And that house actually, that house plays an important role in this project because it was the selling of that house or the closing up of that house after his death, and you were kind of going through stuff that sort of got you started on this letters project. Isn't that right?
That's right. I had made sure all his papers were safe. They were in his studio across our lawn, where we had lived for 4 years before we moved to the and fixed up the old farmhouse. So I secured all the papers he'd left there and sent them to Duke. But then I went back to the little, really children's bedroom. It was our daughter Polly's all-white bedroom as opposed to his big dark studio across the lawn. And he came to work there the last few years of his life, where he wanted to be close, and that was good. And I then went over to this white room that he was in with a big window, which was just opposite from the big dark wall he'd looked at the whole 40 years he was writing across the way, and opened the bureau drawers, and they were stuffed with letters that he had received in the last decade.
Wow.
And they were fascinating and fun. I mean, they were from, you know, anybody from Mia Farrow to Philip Roth to these were letters to him.
Yeah.
And the whole panoply of friends and writers of that decade. And I sent them to Duke, and then I thought, oh, boy, I wonder what he wrote. Peter Matheson and John Updike, and it was after his, after a lot of his literary friends had died, but these were his last decade remaining close friends.
Yeah.
So I put the word out that I wanted to retrieve his letters, and Random House wanted collected letters, and didn't know what I'd get, but pretty soon, as I said to somebody, the mailbox on Ruckham Road was overflowing like a sorcerer's apprentice with 1,000 letters.
Unbelievable. I'm speaking with Rose Styron. She's a poet, an activist, wife and wife of author William Styron. She's also the editor of a book of his letters, a new book of her late husband's letters. Rose, what is going through your mind as these letters start coming in? I mean, I got to imagine that you're going through a range of emotions. Like, should I read these? You know, like, am I being voyeuristic? Am I going to find out something I don't want to find out? Like, who are these people who are writing? Like, what are you feeling as these are coming in, these thousands of letters are coming in?
Well, you're on the mark. You're echoing exactly
what
I felt. And I couldn't at first decide whether to read them.
Then how long did you wait? How long did you wait?
Not very long.
30 seconds. I'd have waited about 10.
Yeah. But, I mean, I had misgivings, but I wasn't going to let that stop me from reading them. And they were so endlessly varied and fascinating and such an evidence of the deep and singular friendships he had with other writers, with his father, with our children, with, you know, his friends and colleagues everywhere that— They were letters of detailed craft of writing, his own and other people's, because people wrote letters in those days. And then the miracle was that he recorded every minute of our lives, which I'd forgotten. So
yeah.
he was sitting there quietly recording all this in letters to his friends year after year after year. And I was running around, of course, being my peripatetic self. And not only didn't remember a lot of this, I mean, it brought it all back. So
yeah.
I remembered it when I heard it, but had no idea that he cared about it all so deeply.
Mm.
So that was a great gift to me.
So, like, it's like going through a photo album for you of your life in a way.
Yeah.
But in words.
That's just what it was. It came back in snapshots and individual letters, and then they all sort of melded in my head. And,
yeah.
And Bob was right to make it come out chronologically, which is not what I would have done. But it was like a, you know, a quiet autobiography of Bill and what he was thinking that didn't have a whole lot to do with our public lives or our private lives. Mm. Often it was his thoughts, but sometimes
really things that happen, including, I want to have you read a passage of one of these letters here. And this is one that I know has particularly struck you. This is one of those moments in your lives. And this is a day that you both spent sailing with the President of the United States, Mr. John F. Kennedy. And maybe you could read some of this letter. Maybe you can also tell us a little bit about that day. Set it up for us.
Well, I'll set it up by saying we had been lucky enough to be at the White House the season before. Mm. We had been invited for the Nobel Prize dinner.
Not bad.
And Bill had had a wonderful time with Jackie Kennedy, whom he describes in that letter. There's a fine White House letter that precedes this. And Jackie had said, oh, we'll take you out sailing when we come to Hyannis this summer. And by God, they did. That's what set this up. And they came over from Hyannis Port with Gene and Steve Smith and Caroline and our friends John and Sue Marquand told us to come to the Edgartown dock.
Yeah.
The public dock. And we'd board from there.
Hmm.
I'll have to I don't know how much I'm going to read here.
You start reading where we have it highlighted there.
Okay.
All right.
The conversation became literary, and although I don't think JFK has really much profound understanding of literature at all, this his tastes are rather square and conventional. He liked Leon Uris's battle cry. He has a remarkable interest in literary matters, as he does in other matters. His mind is wide-ranging and fantastically filled with facts. Not a profound mind, but an enormously sharp one. And when he asks you a question and you answer him, you feel that he is listening to every word you say. In this respect, I think he resembles Teddy Roosevelt like no one else. A very vital and magnetic man, whether you agree with him or not.
That's Rose Styron. She's the wife of author William Styron and the editor of a book of his letters. She was just reading about a day they spent with JFK. What I love about this is, again, because this is a letter that he's writing to, I believe, his editor in this one, he's being very honest with an assessment of a very powerful man here.
He's actually writing to his father.
He's writing to his father on this
I'm
one,
not
yes.
sure he would have said anything like this about JFK, somebody more public than his father, but they were very close and they wrote constantly to each other.
Yeah. Did you have any misgivings or did you worry at all about publishing any of these letters, like ones to his father, like this kind of thing, which did you feel like he had an expectation of privacy or did you wrestle with that at all?
You know, I didn't because I remember him saying that he didn't think letters should be published during anybody's lifetime, that would invade their privacy. And I worried about invading his privacy and our, you know, private code of behavior together when I started this. But I remember that he said, once a writer is dead,
All bets are off.
All bets are off, and so it would be fine. So then I didn't.
Do you think he was writing these letters with the idea being that they would eventually be discovered, be published, or do you think he was just, you know, kind of going through his day and just connecting with people and didn't really think legacy as he was doing this?
I don't think he ever thought of legacy for his letters. I think they were private musings between him and his friends. Some people keep copies of letters. Bill did not. I think it was his moments of reality, maybe to balance the long struggle with fiction, and maybe when he couldn't write the fiction, he wrote about reality to his friends, but he didn't think about the future.
People talk about the fact that when you're trying to get one thing done, if you're procrastinating on it, you can get a whole bunch of other stuff done. It strikes me that as a lot of these letters, maybe he's trying to work on his novels or whatever, and he's just procrastinating and having these amazing correspondences.
Eventually came to be my assessment too. I didn't think of it in the beginning.
Yeah, that's really interesting. One of the things that loomed large in his life was a battle with depression, which obviously he wrote about in a hugely influential work, something that's still read widely today, and that's Darkness Visible, 1990, about his battle with depression. I want you to read an excerpt from this letter to your daughter, Susanna, because I find this interesting because he seems in this letter to be responding to what must have been for her something she talked to him about, being a little bit of a crisis, an existential crisis she was going through. And you can see what a big thinker he is here, and somebody who has the kind of empathy that comes with, I think, somebody who's wrestled with depression and the weight of these big issues in the world. And if you could maybe read this excerpt for us a little bit about this.
It's interesting that you picked this because this was our firstborn daughter who had just turned 17 and was living abroad at the time. He felt very tenderly towards her. As for your existential wrestling, I'm sure that I don't have to tell you that your pondering and wondering and troubling are only extensions of what people have been doing ever since they had the capability of thought, which is to say hundreds of thousands of years. Gods and the idea of God were, of course, born out of just this trouble pondering, so it may or may not be a consolation to you that your intense wonder and turmoil about the meaning of the human condition is, in fact, a part of the human condition, or at least as it is experienced by sensitive and questing souls like you, like yourself, no joke. It may just be that there is no reason or purpose for existence. Many great men, thinkers, and artists have thought this to be true, yet have not despaired over this assumption, but have created great work through their very vision of mankind enduring triumphant over the sheer purposelessness of the universe, and in spite of the bleak and soulless aspect of it so often present. The whole concept of tragedy is, of course, embodied in this notion.
Rose, what goes through your mind when you read something like this? This is, you know, your husband, you know, writing to your daughter with him. In a moment like this, or moments like this throughout this book when you're reading these letters, is this a confirmation of a man you knew? Is this a different man than you knew?
It's the confirmation and enhancing of a man that I knew. It's a man who speaks differently and writes differently from what he speaks, but who has always exquisite language, which he puts down, whether it's his novels or his letters, and also a really tender concern for his daughter, Susanna, and his other children, but also for young writers who he was very generous to and who he read the works of and discussed philosophy with.
Mm. You feel good about the book? You happy with it, how it came out?
Yeah. Surprised. and happy that it came out so well.
That's great. All right. Well, we've been talking with Rose Styron. She's a poet, activist, and the wife of William Styron. She's the editor, along with historian R. Blakeslee Gilpin, of a book of her late husband's letters. We've just heard her reading from him. As a reminder, I said this earlier, but Rose is going to be in conversation today at Harvard Bookstore in Harvard Square. That happens at 7 o'clock tonight. We'll have links on our website for that as well. Rose, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today.
Thank you.
And there's Callie Crossley here to wrap up the show. Callie, take us home.
I'm taking you home. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. I'm Callie Crossley. Have an absolutely great afternoon.
That was serious.